So I'm going to get started now. What I'm talking about today is part of my dissertation project, which is I'm evaluating the cost and effectiveness of full-service partnership programs in Los Angeles County, which are part of the Mental Health Services Act. And they're essentially a sort of community treatment programs for people with severe mental illness. And I want to acknowledge my dissertation committee, Susan Etner is my chair, John Brecky, Ron Hayes, Gerald Kaminsky, and Alexander Young. My work was funded by an NIMH F31, and the data are from an NIMH R01 that Joel Braslow and John Brecky have, looking at the MHSA implementation in LA County. So the Mental Health Services Act, which a lot of you may be familiar with, was passed by voter initiative in November 2004 in California. And it creates a really unprecedented increase in public mental health services for severe mental illness. A lot of people refer to it as the millionaire tax because it imposed a 1% tax on personal incomes over $1 million, which was probably why it was able to pass. And in 2006, 2007, the revenues were about $1 billion for that year. So it's quite a bit of money. And part of the act stipulated that the funds couldn't be used for existing services. And the logic for that was, if you come up with this new funding source, then the state government would just say, great, we don't have to use general funds for mental health care anymore. The downside to that has been, this has been a time also when the state budget is not in good shape. So existing programs are shrinking at a time when there's all this money for new programs. And the new programs also need to follow a philosophy of recovery, which essentially means that they need to be focused on the whole client and not just symptoms, and have a goal of helping people live full, meaningful lives in spite of having a mental illness, and also take into account the client's own goals for what they want their treatment to accomplish. And each county has its own Mental Health Services Act implementation plan, so we're looking specifically at LA County and the implementation in the Department of Mental Health here. And the program that I'm looking at in particular are the full service partnership programs, which exist, I believe, in every county. They were a big part of the act, and they're a major component of the implementation plan. They're essentially a sort of community treatment plan teams. And the precursors in California were the AB 34 and 2034 programs, which the evidence from those, although the data on it, the methods weren't so great, were kind of used as an impetus for that Mental Health Services Act. And these programs provide intensive and integrated services for individuals with severe mental illness. They are treatment teams that are interdisciplinary, so they include a psychiatrist, caseworkers, housing specialists, employment specialists, and client and parent advocates. The ratio of staff to clients can't be more than 1 to 15, or 15 to 1, and they're available to clients 24/7 and will go out to clients in the field to provide services. So for people who are homeless and unable to come in or don't want to come in, they'll go to them. And the target population for these programs are these three main focal population criteria, and clients need to meet one of them to be eligible for an FSP, and they also need to have a diagnosis of severe mental illness. So in the past year, they needed to have been homeless for at least 120 days, or in jail for at least 30 days, or in acute or long-term psychiatric facilities, either 6 months in an institute for mental disease or state hospital, or 28 days in a county or fee-for-service hospital, or 10 episodes of psychiatric emergency or urgent care, which could also include mobile response teams. And then there's also a category for clients who don't meet any of these criteria but are dependent on their families and live with their families and aren't really having any mental health system contact, and who, without their family's help, would be at very high risk of these outcomes. So for my portion of the study, my research questions were, what is the effect of the full service partnerships on mental health services utilization and cost, and what is the effect of the enrollment on health-related quality of life outcomes? My hypotheses were that compared with a matched care sample of usual care clients, also receiving care at DMH, the FSP clients would have higher outpatient mental health expenditures, lower inpatient and emergency service expenditures, and lower overall expenditures. And that last one is a pretty optimistic hypothesis, but that is the sort of claim that the Mental Health Services Act was making. Essentially, if we spend the money in the right way, we'll save money in terms of these higher cost, less appropriate forms of care. And then finally, my last hypothesis is that the FSP clients would have higher health-related quality of life than the usual care clients. And those analyses are still in process, so I'm not presenting those results today. But I will also be presenting the results of my measure validation, because I'm using a health-related quality of life measure that hasn't been used longitudinally in this population, but has a lot of promise for being valid for this population. So the questions I'm asking are, does it have good construct validity? Does the overall distribution of scores make sense? Does it vary with diagnosis and by suicidal ideation in ways we would expect? Does it correlate with psychiatric symptom and functioning difficulties? And is it responsive to clinically significant changes in a measure of psychiatric symptoms and functioning? And for a number of these, the measure that I'm using, along with the AQOL, is the BASIS 32, which is a pretty widely used measure of psychiatric symptom and functioning difficulty across diagnoses. So the reasons that I'm looking at this, first, from a policy perspective, the FSPs are a major allocation of resources to a relatively small group of clients. There are about just over 4,000 clients in LA County receiving FSP services. And it's at a time when the county's resources to provide treatment for severe mental illness are scarce, so it's important to know whether these are worth doing, whether they're cost effective. And from a methodological standpoint, it's pretty rare to see preference-weighted health-related quality of life as an outcomes measure in mental health services research. Historically, most mental health services researchers have measured quality of life instead of health-related quality of life, so they are also measuring what kind of resources clients have, and that prevents the research from being comparable to the research done in other health services. And a large reason for this is that there aren't, there are historical reasons for that, but a reason that you don't see the preference-weighted measures is that we don't really have valid and responsive measures for this population that measure health-related quality of life. So as a result of this, you see cost-effectiveness analyses in mental health services that either hold mental health services to a really high standard by being cost-offset analyses. So essentially, the argument is mental health services are worth providing if they save money, if they pay for themselves, which is, you know, a little unreasonable. Or there are studies that are cost-effectiveness analyses, but they use measures that make them not comparable to evaluations of other kinds of services. So sometimes they have a non-quality measure of effectiveness. They might say, what's the cost per averted hospital day, or the cost for a certain amount of improvement on a depression scale, or a cost of a depression-free day. And then recently, there have been some efforts to create a disease-specific utility measure for schizophrenia by mapping utilities to the positive and negative syndrome scale and also some measures of side effects. And that, I think, holds a lot of promise for things like pharmaceutical research where you're doing, in part because the PANSS is an expert rater measure, it's not a self-report measure. So if there are instances where you want to do research where you're really comparing this medication to that medication for this condition, that could be of value, but it's not going to be something where we know whether those scores are comparable to scores on other utility measures for non-mental health conditions. So the article that led me to use the AQOL as my measure in my dissertation research was by Pine and Kaplan and colleagues in 2003, and they evaluated a few preference-weighted health-related quality of life measures in a population with psychotic disorders with either schizophrenia or schizoaffective, and they had both inpatients and outpatients in their sample. And they were looking at the correlation between change scores on the PANSS and depression and side effects, and the correlation with the health-related quality of life change score. So is this instrument responsive to changes? And the QWB was the measure that did the best of the measures that they evaluated, because it did significantly correlate with all the other measures they were looking at. But the effect sizes were small, and it wasn't very sensitive to changes in the more severely ill individuals. So that doesn't make it look very promising for the population that I was looking at. And essentially the concern there was that there might be threshold effects, so you wouldn't be able to detect improvements in people who were so ill to begin with. And then they also looked at the SF-36 visual analog scale, which only significantly correlated with side effects. And they chose not to look at the UroQol or the Health Utilities Index because they felt that they wouldn't work in this population. The UroQol, they felt that the descriptive system was too simple and wouldn't respond to schizophrenia symptom outcomes. And the Health Utilities Index has a within-the-skin focus that doesn't include social functioning, which is a major component of what you would expect to see affecting health-related quality of life in these populations. Then they mentioned the AQOL, but they hadn't been able to evaluate it because it hadn't been published at the time that they started their study. But they felt that it appeared promising, and when I looked at it, it did look more likely to.
Mm-hmm. Can you just clarify, the QWB says significantly correlated, but the correlations aren't very big when you say effect sizes are not large, or is that something different?
The correlations weren't that large. They were significant, but not that large, and I don't remember what the effect sizes were. It's been a while since I've read the article.
I'm trying to figure out effect sizes. Is that right, based on defining change on those depression and side effects and so forth?
Yeah, based on those. So seeing, but I don't remember exactly how they were measuring or calculating it. But it's all, everything they were measuring was looking at the change scores, not just at point in time correlations.
What is the SF-36 FAPS?
I remember. I'm not that familiar with that measure because it's not the SF-60, it's some other effort to map the SF-36 scores to a utility measure, but yeah. Are you familiar with it, or it's maybe you?
I don't know who it was, but I'm sure there's somebody came up with something.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
The, I can't remember. Anyway, it is. It's mapped utilities.
Well, so, but that's visual analog scale. That's why I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's Brazier's SF-60.
Right. I'm not sure. So the AQOL, when I looked into it, had been examined in a population with psychotic disorders, but only cross-sectionally, and was found to have strong criterion-related validity in that cross-section. It correlated significantly with the physical and mental component summary scores from the SF-36, and as you would expect, more highly with the mental component summary than the physical. Or actually, well, this is the AQOL, so maybe that's not that obvious. The Beck Depression Inventory, the Beck Hopelessness Scale, a measure of side effects from antipsychotic drugs, and much less so, but still significantly, with the Global Assessment of Functioning, which is a score that's assigned by case managers or providers. In this case, it was case managers, so that one's not self-report. And the limitations of this were that it was only looking at psychotic disorders, and as you'll see, the population that we're looking at has a much broader range of severe mental illnesses. And it was only cross-sectional, so we still don't know whether it's responsive to change, which, based on Pine and Kaplan's findings from the QWB, is something that's a little worrisome with measures in this population. So our data are from the, as I mentioned, the R01 looking at the Mental Health Services Act implementation in LA County, and one portion of that is focused on client outcomes, and specifically clients in these full service partnership programs. So it's a quasi-experimental design. We have 179 FSP clients, and then we've matched them to 303 usual care clients. And the way we did that was by screening the five-page assessment forms as people were new admissions to the clinic for outpatient services. We had people go through those assessments and find people who looked like they would at least come close to meeting FSP criteria, and then we would approach them to enroll them. And we were in 6 LA County clinics, and we have both survey data and administrative data. The survey data were one measure at the time of enrollment in our study, which unfortunately wasn't always as close to their clinical baseline as we would have liked, and then every 6 months for up to 3 years, and how far out we followed people, depended on when we enrolled them, because we were continually enrolling over the course of a couple of years. So some people were only able to have 1 year of follow-up. So I'm only looking at 1 year of follow-up data. And then our administrative data are from the Department of Mental Health Integrated System Database. So it includes all care provided by DMH, including outpatient, inpatient, residential, emergency, and urgent care, and also inpatient care that's provided by state or fee-for-service hospitals. But it doesn't include jail mental health data, which I should ultimately be able to get, but although that those services are provided by DMH, they're provided within the jails, and they go into a separate data system that's kind of owned by the sheriff's department, so that makes things complicated. And pharmacy data I should be able to get with some limitations, but essentially due to time, don't have those yet.
Sarah, and later on you'll talk about the probably bigger omission, which is the cost of the program itself, like the housing and all that stuff.
Right, yeah, that's true. So this is really only mental health services utilization, and it's not the cost of providing housing, and it doesn't include as outcomes, we don't have homelessness outcomes yet or incarceration outcomes. So there are other averted costs too.
Well, I'm actually thinking right, more
the other
about
way.
The fact
so it goes
that even
both
if you
ways,
show
right.
a cost offset in the mental health side, that doesn't necessarily mean that the overall programs.
Right, right, yeah, because there'll be the costs of housing and then there may be other averted costs. So in both directions. Our population, our client sample, you can see there are significant differences between the FSP and usual care samples, but generally about a quarter of the sample has schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder, a quarter bipolar disorder, a quarter major depression, and then the remaining quarter of clients have either other psychosis, bipolar 2, or an other mood or anxiety disorder. And about a quarter of them have, on top of those diagnoses, have a substance abuse diagnosis, probably considerably more than them do have a substance abuse problem, but it wasn't necessarily diagnosed at admission. And their GAF scores, again, that's something that gets assigned to them when they come in by a clinician, and it's essentially on a scale of 1 to 100 with descriptions at intervals of 10. So it's just sort of the clinician's overall sense of how the client is functioning. It's not the greatest measure, but those are pretty low scores. So they're about 40 in both groups. And then in terms of the FSP criteria, in the previous 6 months, 40% of the FSP clients and 26% of the usual care clients spent some time homeless. And 20% of the FSP clients and 12% of the usual care clients spent some time either in jail or prison. And among those who were homeless or incarcerated, the durations were pretty long, about 3 months of homelessness in both populations, in both samples, and about 2.5 months incarcerated for the FSP clients and about 1.5 months for usual care clients. So these aren't, on average, that brief. And then in terms of utilization in the prior 12 months, about a third of the samples spent some time in an inpatient facility, which would have been like a short-term acute psychiatric hospitalization, and 3% of each in an institute for mental disease, and those are longer stays. IMD step-down facilities and crisis residential facilities we actually only saw among the FSP clients, not in the usual care clients. And then there also was a significant amount of psychiatric emergency room, psychiatric mobile response team, which is where the emergency facility comes to you, to clients in the field, and then psychiatric urgent care center utilization. And those are, the emergency service use is higher among the FSP clients at baseline. And urgent care is pretty much the same across. So the first thing I wanted to go over were the outcomes of the validity. I'm sorry, validity of the AQOL. And feel free to stop me as we go through this if you have questions about it. So the AQOL is a generic preference-weighted health-related quality of life measure, and it's scored on a scale of negative 0.04 to 1, with negative scores considered to be worse than death, and a score of 0 considered equivalent to death, and 1 considered perfect health-related quality of life. And it asks about the past week, which is the same as also the basis measure that I'm using, also asks about the past week. And it has the utility score portion of the measure has 4 domains, each of which have 3 items. It's actually a 15-question instrument, but the first three questions don't contribute to the utility score, and they used to say that you had to administer the whole thing, and now they don't. So it's now essentially a 12-question measure. And the domains and items, these aren't verbatim, these aren't the questions, but these are kind of a summary of what the questions get at. The independent living domain asks about whether you need help looking after yourself, in doing household tasks, and in getting around your home and your community. The social relationships portion asks about the closeness and warmth of relationships, whether the individual has friends or is socially isolated, whether they're lonely or not, and then whether their family role is affected by their health. Physical senses asks about vision, hearing, and communication, whether they can understand others and make themselves understood. And then psychological well-being, disrupted sleep, whether they feel anxious, worried, or depressed, and whether they experience pain or discomfort. So a lot of these are things that you can probably imagine being affected by psychiatric condition. And then the other measure that I'm using in this assessment is the Behavior and Symptoms Identification Scale, or BASIS 32. It's a self-report measure and assesses psychiatric symptoms and functioning difficulty in the past week. It's considered appropriate for a broad range of conditions, and it's used pretty broadly in inpatient and outpatient settings, and is considered a pretty good measure. The scores range from 0, which indicates no difficulty, to 4, which indicates extreme difficulty. So we would expect correlations with the AQOL to be negative, because higher scores on the BASIS indicate that a client is doing worse. And a change of half a point on the BASIS 32 is considered clinically significant. It generates an overall score and also 5 subscale scores: relation to self and others, daily living and role functioning, depression and anxiety, impulsive or addictive behaviors, and psychosis. So in terms of the construct validity of the AQOL, first I looked at the distribution of scores in our population, and as you would expect, it's skewed pretty low. The range, we saw the full range of the measure, negative 0.04 to 1. The mean score was 0.3, the median was 0.23, and the interquartile range is 0.08 to 0.49, so 75% of the sample is below a 0.5. And many of the scores were very low. We had 12% of our sample with scores greater than or equal, less than or equal to 0, which I think is a little worrisome. It makes it seem that perhaps the scores tend to be a little low on this measure, at least in this population. Although when you look at who had those lower scores, there is a fair amount of logic to it, so I don't have a good sense of how low that is. First, looking at the AQOL scores by diagnosis, bipolar disorder, major depression, schizophrenia, and schizoaffective disorder all have medians of about 0.2, and the percentage of clients with scores less than 0 is this bottom row. Those tend to be in the range of 13 to 16 for those more severe diagnoses. And then for bipolar 2 and other mood or anxiety disorders, the median scores are in the range of about 0.3, and you see 8 and 9% with scores equal to or below 0. And then other psychosis, the median scores are much higher. They're above 0.4, and only 2% of the clients had scores equal to or less than 0. So you do see kind of the distribution there that you might expect. And then in terms of suicidal thoughts and behaviors, this is from one question on the BASIS 32, which asks clients how much difficulty they had with suicidal thoughts or behaviors in the past week. And so I broke the population down, the sample down by that, their answers, which ranged from none, essentially no difficulty, to a little, moderate, quite a bit, or extreme. And you see the median scores declining from 0.4, which is among the people who had no difficulty, all the way down to, I think it's negative 0.01 among those who had extreme difficulty with suicidal thoughts or behaviors. And the percentage of clients with scores less than or equal to 0 increases from 5% in those with no difficulty to 55% for those with extreme difficulty. And then the correlation between the Wave 1 AQOL and BASIS 32 scores, so again, this is just one point at a time. This is their first survey. On the left, the rows, we have the BASIS 32 overall score, and then the subscale scores: relation to self and others, daily living and role functioning, depression and anxiety, impulsive and addictive behaviors, and psychosis. And then the columns are the AQOL overall score, and then the domain scores of independent living, social relationships, physical senses, and psychological well-being. So the correlation between the overall measures is -0.63. And I should say, actually, all of these correlations are significant at less than 0.0001. So you can't really distinguish them based on that. The AQOL correlates most highly with depression and anxiety, daily living and role functioning, and relation to self and others, and less so with psychosis and impulsive and addictive behaviors. And you can see that the domains of the AQOL that are correlating most highly with the basis are psychological well-being and social relationships, and then to a lesser extent independent living, and much less so physical senses, which you might expect because that's not something that the basis is really trying to measure. And then if we look at the individual domains of the AQOL, independent living is correlating most highly with psychosis and daily living and role functioning. Social relationships are correlating most highly with relation to self and others, depression and anxiety, and daily living and role functioning. Physical senses, there's not a whole lot of variation in what it's correlating with in the basis 32, which isn't that surprising. And then psychological well-being is correlating most highly with depression and anxiety and daily living and role functioning. And so those correlations make a fair amount of sense in terms of what you might expect with what these different things measure. So to recap that, the overall distribution of scores does make sense, although it looks like it skews a little low. And a tendency toward very low scores could indicate that we could have a problem with threshold effects, which would mean that clients with very low scores would have to improve their psychiatric symptoms and functioning quite a bit before you would see an improvement in their AQOL scores. Then in terms of variation by diagnosis and variation by suicidal ideation, those variations do seem to make sense with what we might expect. I wouldn't have known what to expect in this area in terms of other psychosis, having higher scores here, but these are sort of the more major psychiatric illnesses. The more severe illnesses had much lower scores. And the correlations also made sense between the AQOL and the basis. And then examining responsiveness to change, which was the thing that I think was the most up in the air in terms of how this measure would do. This is a little complicated to follow. What I did was break up the sample based on the degree of change on the basis 32. So the columns from here on over are improvements on the basis because the change is a negative score, and again, higher scores are worse. And from here on over, these are clients doing worse on the basis. So these clients had improvements of greater than 1, and as I mentioned before, an improvement of 0.5 is considered clinically significant. So these are very strong improvements on the basis. And then these are improvements of 0.5, improvements of 0.1 to 1, or decrease from negative 0.5 to 1. And so those are still clinically significant improvements. Improvements of 0 to 0.5 are not clinically significant. Worsening by between 0 and 0.5, also not clinically significant. Worsening by 0.5 to 1 would be clinically significant, and again, from 1 to 4 would be clinically significant. But here, we actually had a very small sample size, so that is harder to interpret. So what we see looking at the clients separated by this, among clients with very large improvements on the basis 32, you see a mean improvement on the AQOL of 0.3, and that's highly significant, and the standardized response mean is 1.15. And then for clients with a smaller but still clinically significant improvement, you see a change on the AQOL of 0.13. So those clients still have a very large improvement on the AQOL. And that's also highly significant with a standardized response mean of 0.48. And then in this category, which is clients whose improvement on the basis 32 was smaller than a clinically significant change, you see a very small increase in AQOL scores that's not significant. And the standardized response mean is 0.14. Clients who got worse by a small amount, their AQOL scores go down by a small amount. And again, that's not significant. And then clients who had a clinically significant worsening in their psychiatric symptoms and functioning had a large decrease on their AQOL scores of 0.15. And that also was significant with a standardized response mean of -0.6. And then again, this category here, these are clients who got much worse, but the sample size is really small. So their AQOL scores will go down, but it's not significant.
There's sort of a gradient, as you'd expect, except for that last category with the small substance.
Right, yeah.
So someone might say, you know, they're kind of measuring the same thing.
Yeah.
Circular or whatever, so it might be nice to do some analysis for you. Look at the items in both instruments and show how they relate, you know.
Oh, okay,
are
yeah.
they clustered together, or is there some distinction there that you can show?
Right.
I'm sure you can. But.
Yeah, I mean, are there good formal ways to do that, or?
Well, you know, like factor analysis.
Okay.
Or
so to recap that, we see clinically significant changes on the basis associated with substantial and clinically significant changes on the AQOL, and larger basis 32 improvements are associated with larger AQOL improvements. So my conclusions regarding the validation of the AQOL are that when we look in this diagnostically diverse sample of people with severe mental illness, the AQOL performs very well in terms of construct validity and responsiveness to change. The biggest concern is the low scores and whether there could be threshold effects, and also whether these scores are potentially not comparable to scores you would get from other utility instruments.
I can ask about the threshold effects, so mm-hmm. I forgot about that. That seems to me like that's in your favor. If they're low to begin with, then you're going to look for improvement, and you're going to mm-hmm. have more opportunity to improve. So what do you mean by threshold effects? Mm-hmm. Unless you're going the other way, you know, you're at the floor and you couldn't go anymore.
I guess I was thinking, if it's easy to get a really low score, then you could improve, but you're still getting that really low score. So if you're somebody whose baseline psychiatric functioning was very low, and as a result you got a negative score on the AQOL, and you improved your psychiatric functioning, you might still get a negative score on the AQOL.
Well, wouldn't it be a smaller negative score?
Smaller negative score.
I mean, it's still limited, isn't it? I mean,
if it can move, like unless you're so much below a threshold that like that you'd still be negative even if things got better, right? Like if you'd still be a negative 0.04 even if things got better, because you can't get smaller than negative 0.04.
Yeah, I think normally you expect the other direction, but I guess you could maybe work out an argument sometime.
So you so you think if this is sort of like truncated, it's kind of like almost like those Tobit models where it all piles up because it doesn't allow you to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. And I don't know if that's true because I don't know why we have so many zeros and negative scores.
But do you see a pile up at that bottom end? That's what I'm...
Yeah.
I know you're saying there's a lot of negatives, but so you're saying there's a cap as to how negative it can go and if there's like...
Yeah, I mean,
I
we
see.
Have a
so
lot
you think
of
really it's, it should have been.
I think you said it can go all the way to minus one.
You'd go to negative 0.04.
That's the empirical range or the.
That's like the theoretical range and our empirical range. They were the same. So you can't get a score that's lower than negative 0.04.
Okay, that's what I haven't understood. So you're saying if somehow the true scores. More negative than that, it's still going to show up as a minus 0.04 given the way the scale is constructed.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
So I must have misunderstood. Yeah. It didn't go from minus 1 to 1?
Like, no, from negative 0.04 to 1. So it's a funny thing with health-related quality of life measures that are supposed to measure utility is that some of them, I think, go to from 0 to 1, and they don't hypothesize a state worse than death, and then some of them go this tiny bit lower than death. To say that you could have a state worse than death, but it doesn't go all the way to minus one.
But how do they pick minus 0.04? That's so arbitrary, isn't it?
Just a little
bit. That's pretty strange. Essentially,
you know, get worse than death. Not much different than being
right.
I mean, so do you get that score if you have a most negative response on every item?
Yeah.
I mean, I understand your argument, but I would think that. If anything has happened, moving that up to some positive responses is not too difficult.
To do.
I mean, I guess it could be even more than something.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess that kind of requires looking at the individual measures, and it's hard without seeing the responses, but, I mean, in part it could be some things like social relationships and independent living and things like that may just be very low in this population and not that easy to improve if you do improve their psychiatric well-being and their psychiatric functioning.
This is one of the few times in my life I've seen a case where I actually thought a Tobit model might be appropriate.
Well, and I mean, this may, yeah, I mean, presumably, you know, if there should be things over here and people are piling up there, then really the measure should be shifted over because zero or close to zero should be the bottom, right? So it kind of looks like maybe people are just, the scores are skewing, are tending lower than they should.
You should add a constant to everybody, is that...
I don't know. I mean, it depends. I don't think, I think people are working on figuring out how the AQOL scores correspond to scores on other utility measures, but it's not there yet, and it probably varies a lot by diagnosis, right, by what you're looking at, so it's a tricky thing.
I have a question, actually. So if those scores less than zero, zero or less than zero, basically mm-hmm. as bad or worse than death, I mean, wouldn't you think that, you know, the vast majority of those folks would be suicidal? I mean, so have you looked at that? Like, have you just limited the sample to those people? I know you look at correlations with suicidal ideation or something.
55%. And I mean, you know, so to the extent that it's rational to be suicidal, you do see, you know, like, a strong relationship there. Yeah, half the people who were very severely suicidal had scores in that range, but I haven't looked at which percentage of, I mean, that only accounts for, like, maybe 11 clients, so I'm not sure.
But if you could take the people that are less than zero...
Right, and look at where they do on this.
Well, no, I should take them and kill them, and you'll actually improve.
Improve. Well, and I haven't looked yet. I mean, we do.
That's why you're at the clinical division.
Yeah. No, you do have to kind of wonder if that measure really is true, and this it's like, you know, worse than being dead. Then what, you know, why do people? Why aren't people having suicidal thoughts? It's sort of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's this week, right? So maybe people know that things are going to, you know.
True, but you measure them at the same time. I mean, you ask them this the same day. The two different measures are from the
right.
same day, right?
Right. No, but I mean, people may be able to think, well, have some hope that 2 weeks from now things will be better, or a year from now things will be better.
Or they might not do it because of family or whatever.
Yeah.
But that
yeah.
doesn't mean they don't have suicidal thoughts, right?
Right. And I mean, we don't know that people believe that they are in a state worse than death, right? I mean, so.
Well, but what I'm saying is, though, that if you're say, you know, if you take the AQOL literally and
right,
you
right.
say, oh, the AQOL is
that we
reality,
believe that you're
then...
in a state worse than death. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how much I believe that 12% of people in our sample are there, but it is a very sick population and with pretty high incidence of suicidality. So, and we do have, I mean, another thing I can look at, I think, we have maybe 8 or 10 people who died during the course of the study, and I haven't looked at what their AQOL scores were, because people die from...
Have you had any suicides, then?
I don't know that we have. I think it's more... I mean, there was someone who was terminally ill. There's kind of an assortment of... and we don't always know.
That's sort of a study design issue, too. You probably had to have some kind of a suicidality protocol
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
just some sort of intervention or
yeah.
something with
right.
them.
Right.
You had to do that with the usual care as well as the
right.
FSP.
Yeah,
so in some sense, they all got some kind of intervention, right?
Yeah. No,
so,
when they were, you know, when the data collectors were concerned, they would call me or John or, you know, one of the PIs to talk to the patient. And then we would make certain that the clinic had gotten in touch with them, one of the clinic providers. So.
Right. It's just for Sarah then and her whatever slide she ends up having at the end of her, or at the end of her, your dissertation when you talk about your limitations.
Right.
That's actually, I mean, that's obviously that's the appropriate thing to do ethically.
Right.
But from
study
design
yeah,
perspective,
yeah,
it kind of screws you up and you got to acknowledge that, and that might be one reason why you actually are don't think you're finding much in terms of effects on health-related quality of life, you
mm-hmm.
know. All these things kind of bias towards the null, right? Because basically even the usual care group is getting some sort of an intervention that you expect to improve their health.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, it's probably pretty mild,
yeah.
but it is a thing. Because basically people would like walk them down to the hall to talk to their
right.
case manager
yeah.
or something
I mean,
like that. Just let the clinic know.
Yeah. I mean, I mean, in a couple of instances, the postdocs were a little more present with the clients, but usually it would just be walking them down the hall or making certain something that they called the clinician.
Mm-hmm. And also just something, you may have already accounted for it, but I mean, there is a high death rate in this population. Anyway,
right.
So I mean, what you're saying may just be the, and it may not be it too.
Yeah, no, I think it probably isn't, yeah. Because we did expect to have mortality in this study. And overall, I felt that this was a good measure to use for this population. It's probably the best one out there that we have in terms of being able to pick up on improvements in psychiatric symptoms and functioning. Does anyone have any other questions about the AQOL validation or suggestions? So the other part that I'm going to present today are the utilization and cost outcomes. Which, essentially, the conclusion is it's very expensive to provide a lot of care. So looking at years, so these columns are the year prior to enrollment, and these are the year following enrollment in admission to care, essentially, in either the FSP or the usual care program. So in the year prior, about half the FSP clients and a quarter of the usual care clients had some outpatient care through DMH. That didn't mean that they were current clients who were shifted over, although some were, and the clinics were allowed to shift over some clients that they felt were being truly underserved in usual care. But a lot of times it's that just sometime in the past year, and it could have been 6 months ago, they were getting like a little bit of case management and then dropped out. And then in the follow-up year, of course, you see everybody getting some outpatient services because they're all admitted to outpatient care, either the FSP or usual care. There's quite a bit of urgent or emergent utilization. 25% of FSP and 18% of usual care were getting emergency room treatment. 17 and 10% were getting mobile response team treatment, and about 20% were getting urgent care. And you see declines in everything essentially except for usual care clients getting urgent care center treatment. That doesn't go down. And that's not that surprising because they don't get seen that often, so it could be that they go in to get a medication filled or something like that, and the FSP clients wouldn't need to do that because there are people available to them all the time. And you see more of a decrease for the mobile response team utilization, which makes sense because the FSPs can go to the clients, so they don't need a mobile response team to come to them, but it doesn't go away entirely. And then inpatient care, about a third of the sample was receiving inpatient care in both samples, and those declined quite a bit. IMD use declined a little bit. And then IMD step down actually went up for the FSP clients, and you know, like probably one client in usual care started getting those services. And that indicates, that's essentially like a long-term low-level residential program, which suggests that these FSP clients had unmet needs and the FSPs provide, you know, met those needs, and there were funds to do so through the MHSA, so not all those clients' needs could get met on a purely outpatient basis, even with the FSP programs. And then crisis residential, you see a little bit of a decrease here, at least there, nothing that's probably that meaningful. But that's just the percentage of clients receiving services. So among those who did receive those services, this is what the mean utilization was. So again, FSP usual care in the prior year and the follow-up year. The outpatient utilization among those with utilization looked really similar to the FSP and usual care clients in the prior year. And then in the follow-up year, the FSP clients are getting much more. They're getting on average 5,000 minutes of outpatient contact compared to 1,000. And the usual care clients are getting just a little bit more than in the prior year, 1,300 minutes. And day treatment, these are really small samples, so you can't really say much about that. Emergency room and mobile response team and urgent care center, these don't look, you know, hugely different. They're about the same between FSP and usual care, both pre and post. And inpatient stays, you see that in the prior year, those FSP clients with inpatient stays had much longer inpatient stays on average than the usual care patients. And that is probably, I mean, that is essentially what was targeted. The FSP clients had a much higher bar in terms of how much utilization they would have had to have to be in the FSP, and we had a hard time finding usual care clients who had such extensive utilization, because if they had, they probably would have been in an FSP. IMDs, you see a similar relationship. And in the follow-up year, you see that among those with inpatient stays, they're shorter than they were in the prior year. And that's a factor of shorter hospitalizations, not fewer hospitalizations, which probably tells us that it's easier to discharge an FSP client when they can discharge them to the FSP than if they're discharging them essentially to the street. And here you can see the IMD step-down stays are pretty long, so when these FSP clients are getting these services in the follow-up year, it's not a short thing. They're getting like 6 months on average in a step-down facility. And so looking at costs, which kind of brings together the percentage of clients getting services and then how many services they're getting, these are overall averages. And these are unadjusted differences. So what this shows is for the FSP clients in year zero, they were getting $1,600 worth of services. In year one, they were getting $15,000 worth of outpatient services. So the difference there is an increase of $14,600. And usual care clients, they were getting $600 worth in year zero, $4,700 worth in year one, so that's an increase of $4,000. And then this column subtracts the usual care from the FSP. So the difference in differences is $9,500. So FSP clients in outpatient utilization costs increased by $9,500 more than the usual care clients. And urgent or emergent costs, the difference in differences is very small and not significant. Inpatient costs, here you do see a pretty large and significant decrease, so it looks like, oh, the FSP clients had higher inpatient costs to start with, and they decreased by significantly more than the usual care clients decreased. And then residential care, you see actually the increase for the FSP clients relative to usual care, which makes sense because of those IMD step-down stays that they're now receiving.
Are those numbers like on average for one individual client?
Yeah, on average per client. So you can tell that it's actually quite a bit of spending, $15,000 for outpatient. And the inpatient costs in the prior year were high, but not so high that you could ever imagine a decrease in them offsetting the increase in outpatient services, because this is just such a large number. So essentially the services use that I don't have here is the jail mental health services, which I don't know how large that will be.
Is there an assumption that those high costs are going to be that high year after year?
That's not clear. So the county has this belief that people will flow through services and that they'll put you in an FSP, and after a little while in an FSP, you'll be stabilized, and then you can kind of travel down to usual care, and then you can pass from there into a wellness clinic where you'll get kind of some peer services and stop in and get a medication. And I think that's a pretty unreasonable assumption for a lot of our clients, because if it were that easy, it's hard to imagine, if you imagine that you are the millionaire whose money is going to this and you have a child with severe mental illness, like, and you could spend everything in the world, like, what kind of outcomes can you get, and how long could you keep things stable? I mean, it's a hard thing to do. So I think the county believes that that for those clients, they will go down because they could flow into less intensive services, but I don't know that we'll see that, and we haven't looked yet past 1 year. Yeah, go down and come back up, and then, if they do move people into less intensive services, you'll probably see a bounce back in some areas.
It's been, I think, pretty difficult to move people out of the FSPs, though, once they're in. Do you off the top of your head know what proportion have been discharged from? I think in general it's been pretty hard for people to discharge them from the FSP, although they had plans to get them within a year out, I think.
Well, I don't know about Los Angeles yet, but I do know from two other counties that one of the problems that a lot of the FSPs have clients that they would love to move on, But they don't have, they're not set up in a step-down way so that the clients would lose their housing.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want clients to lose the housing, so clients are being kept in the FSP. We don't need to be.
And then do they receive less intensive services within the FSP, or do they kind of keep getting the same?
Well, it's just a problem.
Right.
It's a problem because they don't need the intensive level of services, but that there are not less intensive programs. I mean, some places are developing them. This is something that's you know, seems to be being worked on, just more or less different places.
Yeah.
Just throw it out there. I guess, from what I've seen, I would be a little bit less pessimistic.
About in terms of clients who are able to.
What kind of clients are you looking at? I mean, what counties and what diagnosis? You know, I mean,
it's by diagnosis. Mm-hmm. All of the clients in the FSPs so far, San Diego and San Francisco.
But it just seems to me like something like major depression. I mean, I know it's recurrent, but it's not chronic the way schizophrenia is. So it seems to me like diagnosis ought to matter.
Yeah, I mean, it does matter.
In an
everyday sense, it does. That's why. And that's what I'm curious. I mean, it's. Mm-hmm.
And substance abuse probably matters severe. In terms of how long you can.
Because with given sufficient, you know, step down services or whatever, you think that you could keep the major depression from occurring. Mm-hmm. Whereas schizophrenia, you're going to have it and you're always going to need the support there. So.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of what has driven the ideology has been this recovery ideology. That has, based on the belief that people, even with severe psychotic disorders, will be able to function more independently, which is remains to be seen.
You also have to be employed, and the prospects for somebody with schizophrenia to get sufficient employment to kind of fund their own housing and all that stuff.
So overall, the the difference here is that FSP clients are getting $10,000 more in services than they were getting in the prior year, and their total cost is about $19,000. And the FSP clients are getting about $6,000 worth of services, which is an increase of just under $3,000. So the overall difference in differences here is $8,000. But again, this is unadjusted. So when we look at the adjusted difference in differences, which are it's the coefficient on FSP status in a regression of the cost change, the change in costs on FSP status, and then all of these covariates, you see an adjusted difference in differences of about $11,000. And that's being driven, of course, by the outpatient services going up so much for FSP. You don't see any reductions for urgent or emergent care or for inpatient care. And that's probably because of, among the things I'm adjusting for are the baseline utilization, so the number of inpatient days, number of IMD days, number of outpatient minutes, number of emergency minutes. And the FSP clients started out with such higher hospitalization costs and utilization that essentially they may have just regressed to the mean more. It may have been a lot to do with how high they started up, so they could go down by more. And then residential care goes up for the FSP clients relative to usual care. And so overall, essentially, these are very expensive programs. You see a much higher increase in outpatient services, and it's not offset by a decrease in other areas. And there's an increase in the residential care, like the IMD step-down facilities. So the next steps, first in the current project, which is the part that I'm going to finish up for the dissertation, I want to do a propensity score sensitivity analysis just to look at the sample match and make sure that it makes sense and whether there are any clients that should be kicked out. And then the analysis on the health-related quality of life outcomes, which is still in progress, and I need to look at differential attrition and things like that. But essentially, it does not look like there's going to be a differential improvement. The FSP clients don't have a bigger increase in health-related quality of life. And actually, we see some improvement on their basis scores, but the improvements on the basis scores are maybe in the neighborhood of 0.25. So it's not a clinically significant improvement. So it's not something where we would actually expect to see, based on what we saw in the responsiveness, to change the AQOL scores to go up. And then in the future, so currently we have cleaned up their baseline homelessness and incarceration data, but we don't have the follow-up data cleaned up yet, but we will have that, so to see what happened to incarceration and hospitalization. I want to look at the cost and health-related quality of life data from the full 3 years, and then incorporate additional costs, the housing costs, pharmacy costs, incarceration and jail mental health costs, and the employment income, because we do ask clients about their employment, and that's probably not going to be that large, but we do have clients who got employment. And then look at the utilization patterns to really understand the differences between the programs and what services clients are receiving and when.
It's a shame your sample size is so small, because it'd be sort of interesting to look at whether the intervention effects were different for those who are substance abusers versus not.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, I don't know, I'm just hypothesizing that maybe it's a really different thing, like those that don't abuse substance. Well, it depends too on how successful a program is at getting rid of their substance abuse, but.
Yeah, and substance abuse is tough because it's the, whether they have a diagnosis. We also have their initial baseline scores, and there's a question on there that asks if they have difficulty with drugs or alcohol. And there are people who say yes to that who don't have a substance abuse diagnosis and vice versa. So we can kind of construct a larger population based on that, you know, sort of an either or diagnosis or self-endorsed, but our basis scores aren't always at baseline. So that's something that's hard. Although I don't know how much you would expect people to pick up a new substance abuse problem after they started treatment. I mean, it might be okay to use.
But you have such a small sample.
Right. Yeah, it depends on what room I'm in. Some people think it's a really big sample size. Economists never do.
The usual care group, they're sort of comparable in severity, but they weren't eligible for an FSB.
Right.
What are some of the reasons that they weren't eligible?
They probably, in a lot of cases, we found people who had incarceration or homelessness or hospitalizations, but probably not to the extent that you would have needed. I mean, that's a large part of it. For me, something that's the biggest problem, I mean, we can adjust for those things, but I think the biggest problem in terms of comparability is that to get into usual care, you have to show up at the clinic at like 8 in the morning and wait in line for half a day and have your assessment and be told, okay, come back in a month and a half for your first appointment. And it takes a certain amount of tenacity. And the FSP clients, some of them were people who presented for usual care and were pulled into an FSP program, but a lot of them were selected through outreach at probably like homeless shelters, referred from hospitals or jails, and things like that. And we don't know if those clients ever would or could have come to usual care and stuck with care in usual care. So even if they don't do much better than usual care clients, it doesn't mean that they would have done as well as our usual care clients did in usual care, because maybe this is what you have to do to get these clients into treatment and get them to stay in treatment.
And then the number of FSP slots is quite limited if you in relationship to the total number of patients seen. Mm-hmm. There, but how many, 2,000 or 4,000, I always get that number confused, FSP slots in the county, in LA County, which is the largest county, and out of 100,000 plus patients seen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's fairly small, relatively speaking.
And not every clinic has an FSP program. Some of them, I guess, I don't know, they weren't all offered, but some definitely chose not to have one, right?
And so they did it in a sort of rolled out kind of manner, so that there was a series of, I think they had first 6, then 12, and then it kept increasing the number of clinics.
Jay, you think it's, so is the implication that you think it's sort of quasi-randomized? Because what Sarah was saying before, it's not like it was a conservative bias, maybe.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You'd expect those people to have a smaller trajectory over time. That you'd expect the FSP clients to have had the smaller improvements over time in the absence of than the usual care. So
yeah.
That's sort of conservative.
Yeah.
Although unfortunately, because the conservative bias, you don't find any,
right,
any differences, so you don't really know.
Yeah, we just can't know. So, I mean, my conclusion here would definitely not be like, these don't work, it's all, you know what I mean? Like, I can't say that based on what we have, but it definitely doesn't, it's not, you know, it's not an optimistic set of findings.
Right, because it would have to be a really big change in quality, health-related quality of life to, I mean, because not only was the 10,000, you know, sizable sum, but mm-hmm. also once, I know you're saying there's other sources of cost offset,
right,
but the housing's got to be expensive because it's like individual housing, right? It's not even like, it's not like a group home or something. It's expensive. I mean,
sometimes it can be like board and cares and things like that, right? It's not always. Mm-hmm. And there's a funny thing. One of our ethnographers says he found in interviews that clients often seem to be doing worse after they get housing sometimes because they might have been in some sort of residential setting where they like they had a community, they were around other people, and then they're like, you know what, we found you this, you know, this low cost apartment across town, like away from, now you're going to go to this other clinic, you know, like it could really kind of disrupt people's social networks. So it's a weird thing. It's not very perfect how it's done.
Sarah, very interesting. In terms of future analyses, many of them were incarcerated, almost all of them. And presumably when they were incarcerated, they had some treatment
mm-hmm.
because they're under observation that comes with the game. So would it be important to control for the time since they were incarcerated?
Oh,
maybe even the magnitude of what they received?
The number that had been histories of incarceration, I couldn't say most of them had histories.
Maybe about there was an average of 90 days. So
that was, but no, that's among those who were incarcerated.
Yeah, no.
So it's about a quarter of the sample. But no, I mean that's something where something we ideally wanted to have in our sample match was similar kind of recency of these events. So recency mm-hmm. of hospitalization, recency of homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we can control for that. I mean, it's hard because not everybody was, you know, so you'd only be looking at the subset of people who were incarcerated because otherwise you wouldn't have a measure.
Or some
of
that.
Yeah.
Yes, no, and then how, you know, more than 6 months or
something
like that.
Yeah.
But you have the data. You do part of that.
Yeah, we do usually have the dates of when things occurred to the extent to which people could remember.
And I think you said you were trying to link that data set with the sheriffs in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we get it through that data set. We can get through DMH, but it's complicated, and they always make it sound really hard. Those data are supposed to be somehow transported over from the EDAR data set to the MIS, but they kind of think that it might not actually be happening, and the sheriff's department may use a booking number and not the IS number. So it'll be work, but I think it will eventually happen. It's just been sort of an issue of how much we lean on them for any piece of the data at any one time, and you kind of like lean on a piece, and then when you get that piece, you move on to the next one.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, so we should be able to get the jail mental health data. And
any other questions? Thank you.